On a recent visit, I filled my shopping cart with eggs from cage-free vegetarian hens, milk from cows that live free from unnecessary fear and distress, wild salmon caught by Native Americans in Yakutat, Alaska, population 833, and heirloom tomatoes from Capay Farm, $4.99 a pound, one of the early pioneers of the organic movement. The organic broiler I picked up even had a name, Rosie, who turned out to be a sustainably farmed, free-range chicken from Petaluma Poultry, a company whose farming methods strive to create harmonious relationships in nature, sustaining the health of all creatures and the natural world. Okay, not the most mellifluous or even meaningful sentence, but at least their heart's in the right place. In several corners of the store, I was actually forced to choose between subtly competing stories. For example, some of the organic milk in the milk case was ultra-pasteurized, an extra processing step that was presented as a boon to the consumer, since it extends shelf life. But then another, more local dairy boasted about the fact that they had said no to ultra-pasteurization, implying that their product was fresher, less processed, and therefore more organic. This was the dairy that talked about cows living free from distress, something I was beginning to feel a bit of myself by this point. This particular dairy's label had a lot to say about the bovine lifestyle. Its Holsteins are provided with an appropriate environment, including shelter and a comfortable resting area, sufficient space, proper facilities, and the company of their own kind. All this sounded pretty great, until I read the story of another dairy selling raw milk, completely unprocessed, whose cows graze green pastures all year long, which made me wonder whether the first dairy's idea of an appropriate environment for a cow included, as I had simply presumed, a pasture. All of a sudden, the absence from their story of that word seemed weirdly conspicuous. As the literary critics would say, the writer seemed to be eliding the whole notion of cows and grass. Indeed, the longer I shopped in Whole Foods, the more I thought that this is a place where the skills of a literary critic might come in handy. Those, and perhaps also a journalist's. Wordy labels, point-of-purchase brochures, and certification schemes are supposed to make an obscure and complicated food chain more legible to the consumer. In the industrial food economy, virtually the only information that travels along the food chain linking producer and consumer is price. Just look at the typical newspaper ad for a supermarket. The sole quality on display here is actually a quantity. Tomatoes, 69 cents a pound. Ground chuck, $1.09 a pound. Eggs, 99 cents a dozen. Special this week. Is there any other category of product sold on such a reductive basis? The bare-bones information travels in both directions, of course, and farmers who get the message that consumers care only about price will themselves care only about yield. This is how a cheap food economy reinforces itself. One of the key innovations of organic food was to allow some more information to pass along the food chain between the producer and the consumer. An implicit snatch of narrative along with the number. A certified organic label tells a little story about how a particular food was produced, giving the consumer a way to send a message back to the farmer that she values tomatoes produced without harmful pesticides or prefers to feed her children milk from cows that haven't been injected with growth hormones. The word organic has proved to be one of the most powerful words in the supermarket. Without any help from government, farmers and consumers working together in this way have built a $10 billion industry that is now the fastest growing sector of the food economy. Yet, the organic label itself, like every other such label in the supermarket, is really just an imperfect substitute for direct observation of how a food is produced. A concession to the reality that most people in an industrial society haven't the time or the inclination to follow their food back to the farm. A farm which today is apt to be, on average, 1,500 miles away. So, to bridge that space, we rely on certifiers and label writers and, to a considerable extent, our imagination of what the farms that are producing our food really look like. The organic label may conjure an image of a simpler agriculture, but its very existence is an industrial artifact. The question is, what about the farms themselves? How well do they match the stories told about them? Taken as a whole, the story on offer in Whole Foods is a pastoral narrative in which farm animals live much as they did in the books we read as children, and our fruits and vegetables grow in well-composted soils on small farms, much like Joel Salatin's. Organic, on the label, conjures up a rich narrative, even if it is the consumer who fills in most of the details, supplying the hero, American family farmer, the villain, agribusinessman, and the literary genre, which I've come to think of as supermarket pastoral. By now, we may know better than to believe this too simple story, but not much better. And the grocery store poets do everything they can to encourage us in our willing suspension of disbelief. Supermarket pastoral is a most seductive literary form, beguiling enough to survive in the face of a great many discomforting facts. I suspect that's because it gratifies some of our deepest, oldest longings, not merely for safe food, but for a connection to the earth and to the handful of domesticated creatures we've long depended on. Whole Foods understands all this better than we do. One of the company's marketing consultants explained to me that the Whole Foods shopper feels that by buying organic, he is engaging in authentic experiences and imaginatively enacting a return to a utopian past with the positive aspects of modernity intact. This sounds a lot like Virgilian pastoral, which also tried to have it both ways. In The Machine in the Garden, Leo Marx writes that Virgil's shepherd Tityrus, no primitive, enjoys the best of both worlds, the sophisticated order of art and the simple spontaneity of nature. In keeping with the pastoral tradition, Whole Foods offers what Marx terms a landscape of reconciliation between the realms of nature and culture, a place where, as the marketing consultant put it, people will come together through organic foods to get back to the origin of things. Perhaps by sitting down to enjoy one of the microwavable organic TV dinners. Four words I never expected to see conjoined, stacked in the frozen food case. How's that for having it both ways? Of course, the trickiest contradiction Whole Foods attempts to reconcile is the one between the industrialization of the organic food industry, of which it is a part, and the pastoral ideals on which that industry has been built. The organic movement, as it was once called, has come a remarkably long way in the last 30 years, to the point where it now looks considerably less like a movement than a big business. Lining the walls above the sumptuously stocked produce section in my Whole Foods are full-color photographs of local organic farmers accompanied by text blocks setting forth their farming philosophies. A handful of these farms, Cape is one example, still sell their produce to Whole Foods, but most are long gone from the produce bins, if not yet the walls. That's because Whole Foods has adopted the grocery industry's standard regional distribution system, which makes supporting small farms impractical. Tremendous warehouses buy produce for dozens of stores at a time, which forces them to deal exclusively with tremendous farms. So while the posters still depict family farmers and their philosophies, the produce on sale below them comes primarily from the two big corporate organic growers in California, Earthbound Farm and Grimway Farms, which together dominate the market for organic fresh produce in America. Grimway Farms owns Cal Organic, one of the most ubiquitous organic brands in the supermarket. Earthbound alone grows 80% of the organic lettuce sold in America. As I tossed a plastic box of Earthbound pre-washed spring mix salad into my Whole Foods cart, I realized that I was venturing deep into the belly of the industrial beast Joel Salatin had called the organic empire. Speaking of my salad mix, another small, beyond organic farmer, a friend of Joel's, had told me he wouldn't use that stuff to make compost, the organic purist's stock insult. But I'm not prepared to accept the premise that industrial organic is necessarily a bad thing. Not if the goal is to reform a half-trillion-dollar food system based on chain supermarkets and the consumer's expectations that food be convenient and cheap. And yet, to the extent that the organic movement was conceived as a critique of industrial values, surely there comes a point when the process of industrialization will cost organic its soul, to use a word still uttered by organic types without irony, when supermarket pastoral becomes more fiction than fact. Another lie told by marketers. The question is, has that point been reached, as Joel Salatin suggests? Just how well does supermarket pastoral hold up under close reading and journalistic scrutiny? About as well as you would expect anything genuinely pastoral to hold up in the belly of an $11 billion industry, which is to say, not very well at all. At least that's what I discovered when I traced a few of the items in my Whole Food cart back to the farms where they were grown. I learned, for example, that some, certainly not all, organic milk comes from factory farms, where thousands of Holsteins that never encounter a blade of grass spend their days confined to a fenced, dry lot, eating certified organic grain and tethered to milking machines 3 times a day. The reason much of this milk is ultra-pasteurized, a high-heat process that damages its nutritional quality, is so big companies like Horizon and Aurora can sell it over long distances. I discovered organic beef being raised in organic feedlots and organic high-fructose corn syrup, more words I never expected to see combined. And I learned about the making of the aforementioned organic TV dinner, a microwavable bowl of rice, vegetables, and grilled chicken breasts with a savory herb sauce. Country herb, as the entree is called, turns out to be a highly industrialized organic product, involving a choreography of 31 ingredients assembled from far-flung farms, laboratories, and processing plants scattered over a half dozen states and 2 countries, and containing such mysteries of modern food technology as high oleic safflower oil, guar and xanthan gum, soy lecithin, carrageenan, and natural grill flavor. Several of these ingredients are synthetic additives permitted under federal organic rules. So much for whole foods. The manufacturer of Country Herb is Cascadian Farm, a pioneering organic farm-turned-processor from Washington State that is now a wholly-owned subsidiary of General Mills. The Country Herb chicken entree has since been discontinued. I also visited Rosie the Organic Chicken at her farm in Petaluma, which turns out to be more animal factory than farm. She lives in a shed with 20,000 other Rosies, who, aside from their certified organic feed, live lives little different from that of any other industrial chicken. Ah, but what about the free-range lifestyle promised on the label? True, there's a little door in the shed leading out to a narrow grassy yard. But the free-range story seems a little dubious when you discover that the door remains firmly shut until the birds are at least 5 or 6 weeks old, for fear they'll catch something outside, and the chickens are slaughtered only 2 weeks later. From People's Park to Petaluma Poultry. If you walk 5 blocks north from the Whole Foods in Berkeley along Telegraph Avenue and then turn right at Dwight Street, you'll soon come to a trash-strewn patch of grass and trees dotted with the tattered camps of a few dozen homeless people. Mostly in their 50s and 60s, some still affecting hippie styles of hair and dress, these men and women pass much of their days sleeping and drinking, like so many of the destitute everywhere. Here, though, they also spend time tending scruffy little patches of flowers and vegetables. A few stalks of corn, some broccoli plants gone to seed. People's Park today is the saddest of places, a blasted monument to 60s hopes that curdled a long time ago. And yet, while the economic and social distances separating the well-heeled shoppers cruising the aisles at Whole Foods from the unhealed homeless in People's Park could not be much greater, the two neighborhood institutions are branches of the same unlikely tree. Indeed, were there any poetic justice in the world, the executives at Whole Foods would have long ago erected a commemorative plaque at People's Park and a booth to give away organic fruits and vegetables. The organic movement, much like environmentalism and feminism, has deep roots in the 60s radicalism that briefly flourished on this site. Organic is one of several tributaries of the counterculture that ended up disappearing into the American mainstream, but not before significantly altering its course. And if you trace that particular tributary all the way back to its spring, your journey will eventually pass through this park. People's Park was born on April 20, 1969, when a group calling itself the Robin Hood Commission seized a vacant lot owned by the University of California and set to work rolling out sod, planting trees, and, perhaps most auspiciously, putting in a vegetable garden. Calling themselves agrarian reformers, the radicals announced that they wanted to establish on the site the model of a new cooperative society built from the ground up. That included growing their own uncontaminated food. One of the inspirations for the commission's act of civil disobedience was the example of the diggers in 17th century England, who had also seized public land with the aim of growing food to give away to the poor. In People's Park, that food would be organic, a word that at the time brimmed with meanings that went far beyond any particular agricultural method. In Appetite for Change, his definitive account of how the 60s counterculture changed the way we eat, historian Warren J. Belasco writes that the events in People's Park marked the greening of the counterculture, the pastoral turn that would lead to the commune movement in the countryside, to food co-ops and guerrilla capitalism, and, eventually, to the rise of organic agriculture and businesses like Whole Foods. The moment for such a turn to nature was ripe in 1969. DDT was in the news, an oil spill off Santa Barbara had blackened California's coastline, and Cleveland's Cuyahoga River had caught fire. Overnight, it seemed, ecology was on everybody's lips, and organic close behind. As Belasco points out, the word organic had enjoyed a currency among 19th-century English social critics, who contrasted the social fragmentation and atomism wrought by the Industrial Revolution with the ideal of a lost organic society, one where the bonds of affection and cooperation still held. Organic stood for everything industrial was not. But applying the word organic to food and farming occurred much more recently. In the 1940s, in the pages of Organic Gardening and Farming. Founded in 1940 by J.I. Rodale, a health food fanatic from New York City's Lower East Side, the magazine devoted its pages to the agricultural methods and health benefits of growing food without synthetic chemicals, organically. Joel Salatin's grandfather was a charter subscriber. Organic gardening and farming struggled along in obscurity until 1969, when an ecstatic review in the Whole Earth catalog brought it to the attention of hippies trying to figure out how to grow vegetables without patronizing the military-industrial complex. "If I were a dictator determined to control the national press," the Whole Earth correspondent wrote, "organic gardening would be the first publication I'd squash because it's the most subversive. I believe that organic gardeners are in the forefront of a serious effort to save the world by changing man's orientation to it, to move away from the collective, centrist, super-industrial state toward a simpler, realer, one-to-one relationship with the earth itself." Within 2 years, organic gardening and farming's circulation climbed from 400,000 to 700,000. As the Whole Earth encomium suggests, the counterculture had married the broader and narrower definitions of the word organic. The organic garden planted in People's Park, soon imitated in urban lots across the country, was itself conceived of as a kind of scale model of a more cooperative society, a landscape of reconciliation that proposed to replace industrialism's attitude of conquest toward nature with a softer, more harmonious approach. A pastoral utopia in miniature, such a garden embraced not only the humans who tended and ate from it, but as many life kingdoms as possible, in the words of an early account of Berkeley's People's Gardens in an underground paper called Good Times. The vegetables harvested from these plots, which were sometimes called conspiracies of soil, would supply, in addition to wholesome calories, an edible dynamic. A new medium through which people can relate to one another and their nourishment. For For example, organics' rejection of agricultural chemicals was also a rejection of the war machine, since the same corporations, Dow, Monsanto, that manufactured pesticides also made napalm and Agent Orange, the herbicide with which the U.S. military was waging war against nature in Southeast Asia. Eating organic thus married the personal to the political, which was why much more was at stake than a method of farming. Acting on the ecological premise that everything's connected to everything else, the early organic movement sought to establish not just an alternative mode of production, the chemical-free farms, but an alternative system of distribution, the anti-capitalist food co-ops, and even an alternative mode of consumption, the counter-cuisine. These were the three legs on which organics' revolutionary program stood. Since ecology taught you can never do only one thing, what you ate was inseparable from how it was grown and how it reached your table. A counter-cuisine based on whole grains and unprocessed organic ingredients rose up to challenge conventional industrial white bread food. Plastic food was an epithet thrown around a lot. For a host of reasons that seem ridiculous in retrospect, brown foods of all kinds – rice, bread, wheat, eggs, sugar, soy sauce, tamari – were deemed morally superior to white foods. Brown foods were less adulterated by industry, of course, but just as important, eating them allowed you to express your solidarity with the world's brown peoples. Only later would the health benefits of these whole foods be recognized. Not the first or last time an organic conceit would find scientific backing. But perhaps best of all, brown food was also precisely what your parents didn't eat. How to grow this stuff without chemicals was a challenge, especially to city kids coming to the farm or garden with a head full of pastoral ideals and precisely no horticultural experience. The rural communes served as organic agriculture's ramshackle research stations, places where neophyte farmers could experiment with making compost and devising alternative methods of pest control. The steepness of their learning curve was on display in the food co-ops, where sorry-looking organic produce was the rule for many years. But the freak farmers stuck with it, following Rodale's step-by-step advice, and some of them went on to become excellent farmers. One notable such success was Gene Kahn, the founder of Cascadian Farm, the company responsible for the organic TV dinner in my Whole Foods cart. Today, Cascadian Farm is foremost a General Mills brand, but it began as a quasi-communal hippie farm, located on a narrow, gorgeous shelf of land wedged between the Skagit River and the North Cascades, about 75 miles northeast of Seattle. The idyllic little farmstead depicted on the package turns out to be a real place. Originally called the New Cascadian Survival and Reclamation Project, the farm was started in 1971 by Gene Kahn with the idea of growing food for the collective of environmentally minded hippies he had hooked up with in nearby Bellingham. At the time, Kahn was a 24-year-old grad school dropout from the south side of Chicago, who had been inspired by Silent Spring and Diet for a Small Planet to go back to the land, and from there to change the American food system. This particular dream was not so outrageous in 1971, but Kahn's success in actually realizing it surely is. He went on to become a pioneer of the organic movement and probably has done as much as anyone to move organic food into the mainstream, getting it out of the food co-op and into the supermarket. Today, the eponymous Cascadian Farm is a General Mills showcase, a PR farm, as its founder freely acknowledges, and Kahn, erstwhile hippie farmer, is a General Mills vice president. Cascadian Farms is precisely what Joel Salatin has in mind when he talks about an organic empire. Like most of the early organic farmers, Kahn had no idea what he was doing at first, and he suffered his share of crop failures. In 1971, organic agriculture was in its infancy. A few hundred scattered amateurs learning by trial and error how to grow food without chemicals. An ad hoc grassroots R&D effort for which there was precisely no institutional support. In fact, the USDA was actively hostile to organic agriculture until quite recently, viewing it, quite rightly, as a critique of the industrialized agriculture the USDA was promoting. What the pioneer organic farmers had instead of the USDA's Agricultural Extension Service was organic gardening and farming, to which Kahn subscribed, and the model of various pre-modern agricultural systems, as described in books like Farmers of 40 Centuries by F. H. King and Sir Albert Howard's The Soil and Health and An Agricultural Testament. This last book may fairly be called the movement's Bible. Perhaps more than any other single writer, Sir Albert Howard, 1873 to 1947, an English agronomist knighted after his 30 years of research in India, provided the philosophical foundations for organic agriculture. Even those who never read his 1940 testament nevertheless absorbed his thinking through the pages of Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming, where he was lionized, and in the essays of Wendell Berry, who wrote an influential piece about Howard in the Last Whole Earth Catalog in 1971. Berry seized particularly on Howard's arresting and prescient idea that we needed to treat the whole problem of health in soil, plant, animal, and man as one great subject. For a book that devotes so many of its pages to the proper making of compost, An Agricultural Testament turns out to be an important work of philosophy as well as agricultural science. Indeed, Howard's drawing of lines of connection between so many seemingly discrete realms, from soil fertility to the national health, from the supreme importance of animal urine to the limitations of the scientific method, is his signal contribution, his method as well as his message. Even though Howard never uses the word organic, it is possible to tease all the many meanings of the word as a program for not just agricultural but social renovation from his writings. To measure the current definition of organic against his genuinely holistic conception is to appreciate just how much it has shrunk. Like many works of social and environmental criticism, An Agricultural Testament is in broad outline the story of a fall. In Howard's case, the serpent in question is a 19th century German chemist by the name of Baron Justus von Liebig, his tempting fruit, a set of initials, N.P.K. It was Liebig, in his 1840 monograph, Chemistry in Its Application to Agriculture, who set agriculture on its industrial path when he broke down the quasi-mystical concept of fertility in soil into a straightforward inventory of the chemical elements plants require for growth. At a stroke, soil biology gave way to soil chemistry, and specifically to the three chemical nutrients Liebig highlighted as crucial to plant growth: nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, or to use these elements' initials from the periodic table, NPK. The three letters correspond to the three-digit designation printed on every bag of fertilizer. Much of Howard's work is an attempt to demolish what he called the NPK mentality. The NPK mentality embraces a good deal more than fertilizer, however. Indeed, to read Howard is to begin to wonder if it might not be one of the keys to everything wrong with modern civilization. In Howard's thinking, the NPK mentality serves as a shorthand for both the powers and limitations of reductionist science. For as followers of Liebig discovered, NPK works. If you give plants these three elements, they will grow. From this success, it was a short step to drawing the conclusion that the entire mystery of soil fertility had been solved. It fostered the wholesale reimagining of soil, and with it, agriculture, from a living system to a kind of machine. Apply inputs of NPK at this end, and you will get yields of wheat or corn on the other end. Since treating the soil as a machine seemed to work well enough, at least in the short term, there no longer seemed any need to worry about such quaint things as earthworms and humus. Humus is the stuff in a handful of soil that gives it its blackish cast and characteristic smell. It's hard to say exactly what humus is because it is so many things. Humus is what's left of organic matter after it has been broken down by the billions of big and small organisms that inhabit a spoonful of earth. The bacteria, phages, fungi, and earthworms responsible for decomposition. The psalmist who described life as a transit from dust to dust would have been more accurate to say humus to humus. But humus is not a final product of decomposition so much as a stage, since a whole other group of organisms slowly breaks humus down into the chemical elements plants need to grow. Elements including, but not limited to, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. This process is as much biological as chemical, involving the symbiosis of plants and the mycorrhizal fungi who live in and among their roots. The fungi offer soluble nutrients to the roots, receiving a drop of sucrose in return. Another critical symbiotic relationship links plants to the bacteria in a humus-rich soil that fixes atmospheric nitrogen, putting it into a form plants can use. But providing a buffet of nutrients to plants is not the only thing humus does. It also serves as the glue that binds the minute mineral particles in soil together into airy crumbs and holds water in suspension so that rainfall remains available to plant roots instead of instantly seeping away. To reduce such a vast biological complexity to NPK represented the scientific method at its reductionist worst. Complex qualities are reduced to simple quantities. Biology gives way to chemistry. As Howard was not the first to point out, that method can only deal with one or two variables at a time. The problem is that once science has reduced a complex phenomenon to a couple of variables, however important they may be, the natural tendency is to overlook everything else, to assume that what you can measure is all there is, or at least all that really matters. When we mistake what we can know for all there is to know, a healthy appreciation of one's ignorance in the face of a mystery like soil fertility gives way to the hubris that we can treat nature as a machine. Once that leap has been made, one input follows another, so that when the synthetic nitrogen fed to plants makes them more attractive to insects and vulnerable to disease, as we have discovered, the farmer turns to chemical pesticides to fix his broken machine. In the case of artificial manures, the original term for synthetic fertilizers, Howard contended that our hubris threatened to damage the health not only of the soil, since the harsh chemicals kill off biological activity in humus, but of the national health as well. He linked the health of the soil to the health of all the creatures that depended on it, an idea that, once upon a time before the advent of industrial agriculture, was in fact a commonplace, discussed by Plato and Thomas Jefferson, among many others. Howard put it this way: artificial manures lead inevitably to artificial nutrition, artificial food, artificial animals, and finally, to artificial men and women. Howard's flight of rhetoric might strike our ears as a bit over the top. We are talking about fertilizer, after all. But it was written in the heat of the pitched battle that accompanied the introduction of chemical agriculture to England in the 1930s and 1940s. The Great Humus Controversy, as it was called, actually reached the floor of the House of Lords in 1943, a year when one might have thought there were more pressing matters on the agenda. But England's agriculture ministry was promoting the new fertilizers, and many farmers complained their pastures and animals had become less robust as a result. Howard and his allies were convinced that history will condemn chemical fertilizer as one of the greatest misfortunes to have befallen agriculture and mankind. He claimed that the wholesale adoption of artificial manures would destroy the fertility of the soil, leave plants vulnerable to pests and disease, and damage the health of the animals and peoples eating those plants. For how could such plants be any more nutritious than the soil in which they grew? Moreover, the short-term boosts in yield that fertilizers delivered could not be sustained. Since the chemicals would eventually destroy the soil's fertility, today's high yields were robbing the future. Needless to say, the great humus controversy of the 1940s was settled in favor of the NPK mentality. Howard pointed down another path. "We now have to retrace our steps," he wrote, which meant jettisoning the legacy of Liebig and industrial agriculture. "We have to go back to nature and to copy the methods to be seen in the forest and prairie." Howard's call to redesign the farm as an imitation of nature wasn't merely rhetorical. He had specific practices and processes in mind, which he outlined in a paragraph at the beginning of an agricultural testament that stands as a fair summary of the whole organic ideal. Mother Earth never attempts to farm without live stock. She always raises mixed crops. Great pains are taken to preserve the soil and to prevent erosion. The mixed vegetable and animal wastes are converted into humus. There is no waste. The processes of growth and the processes of decay balance one another. The greatest care is taken to store the rainfall. Both plants and animals are left to protect themselves against disease. Each of the methods at work in a forest or prairie could have its analog on a farm. Animals could feed on plant wastes as they do in the wild. In turn, their wastes could feed the soil. Mulches could protect bare soil in the same way leaf litter in a forest does. The compost pile, acting like the lively layer of decomposition beneath the leaf litter, could create humus. Even the diseases and insects would perform the salutary function they do in nature, to eliminate the weakest plants and animals, which he predicted would be far fewer in number once the system was operating properly. For Howard, insects and diseases, the bane of industrial agriculture, are simply nature's sensors, useful to the farmer for pointing out unsuitable varieties and methods of farming inappropriate to the locality. On a healthy farm, pests would be no more prevalent than in a healthy wood or pasture, which should be agriculture's standard. Howard was thus bidding farmers to regard their farms less like machines than like living organisms. The notion of imitating whole natural systems stands in stark opposition to reductionist science, which works by breaking such systems down into their component parts in order to understand how they work and then manipulating them, one variable at a time. In this sense, Howard's concept of organic agriculture is pre-modern, arguably even anti-scientific. He's telling us we don't need to understand how humus works or what compost does in order to make good use of it. Our ignorance of the teeming wilderness that is the soil, even the act of regarding it as a wilderness, is no impediment to nurturing it. To the contrary, a healthy sense of all we don't know, even a sense of mystery, keeps us from reaching for oversimplifications and technological silver bullets. A charge often made against organic agriculture is that it is more philosophy than science. There's some truth to this indictment, if that is what it is, though why organic farmers should feel defensive about it is itself a mystery. A relic, perhaps, of our fetishism of science as the only credible tool with which to approach nature. In Howard's conception, the philosophy of mimicking natural processes precedes the science of understanding them. The peasant rice farmer who introduces ducks and fish to his paddy may not understand all the symbiotic relationships he's put in play. That the ducks and fishes are feeding nitrogen to the rice and at the same time eating the pests. But the high yields of food from this ingenious polyculture are his to harvest even so. The philosophy underlying Howard's conception of organic agriculture is a variety of pragmatism, of course, the school of thought that is willing to call true whatever works. Charles Darwin taught us that a kind of pragmatism, he called it natural selection, is at the very heart of nature, guiding evolution. What works is what survives. This is why Howard spent so much time studying peasant agricultural systems in India and elsewhere. The best ones survived as long as they did because they brought food forth from the same ground year after year without depleting the soil. In Howard's agronomy, science is mostly a tool for describing what works and explaining why. As it happens, in the years since Howard wrote, science has provided support for a great many of his unscientific claims. Plants grown in synthetically fertilized soils are less nourishing than ones grown in composted soil. Such plants are more vulnerable to diseases and insect pests. Polycultures are more productive and less prone to disease than monocultures. And that, in fact, the health of the soil, plant, Animal, human, and even nation are, as he claimed, connected along lines we can now begin to draw with empirical confidence. We may not be prepared to act on this knowledge, but we know that civilizations that abuse their soil eventually collapse. If farms modeled on natural systems work as well as Howard suggests, then why don't we see more of them? The sad fact is that the organic ideal, as set forth by Howard and others, has been honored mainly in the breach. Especially as organic agriculture has grown more successful, finding its way into the supermarket and the embrace of agribusiness, organic farming has increasingly come to resemble the industrial system it originally set out to replace. The logic of that system has so far proven more ineluctable than the logic of natural systems. The journey of Cascadian Farm from the new Cascadian Survival and Reclamation Project to General Mills subsidiary stands as a parable of this process. On an overcast morning a few winters ago, Con drove me out to see the original farm, following the twists of the Skagit River east in a new forest green Lexus with vanity plates that say organic. Con is a strikingly boyish-looking man in his mid-50s, and after you factor in a shave and 20 pounds, it's not hard to pick his face out from the beards, beads, and tractors photos on display in his office. Walking me through the history of his company as we drove out to the farm, Gene Con spoke candidly and without defensiveness about the compromises made along his path from organic farmer to agribusinessman, and about how everything eventually morphs into the way the world is. By the late 70s, Con had become a pretty good organic farmer and an even better businessman. He had discovered the economic virtues of adding value to his produce by processing it, freezing blueberries and strawberries, making jam. And once Cascadian Farm started processing food, Con discovered he could make more money buying produce from other farmers than by growing it himself. The same discovery conventional agribusiness companies had made a long time before. The whole notion of a cooperative community we started with gradually began to mimic the system, Con told me. We were shipping food around the country, using diesel fuel. We were industrial organic farmers. I was bit by bit becoming more of this world, and there was a lot of pressure on the business to become more privatized. That pressure became irresistible in 1990, when, in the aftermath of the Alar scare, Con nearly lost everything, and control of Cascadian Farm wound up in corporate hands. In the history of the organic movement, the Alar episode is a watershed, marking the birth pangs of the modern organic industry. Throughout its history, the sharpest growth of organic has closely followed spikes in public concern over the industrial food supply. Some critics condemn organic for profiting time and again from food scares. And while there is certainly some truth to this charge, whether it represents a more serious indictment of organic or industrial food is open to question. Organic farmers reply that episodes focusing public attention on pesticides, food poisoning, genetically modified crops, and mad cow disease serve as teachable moments about the industrial food system and its alternatives. Alar was one of the first. After a somewhat overheated 60 Minutes expose on apple growers' use of Alar, a growth-regulating chemical widely used in conventional orchards that the Environmental Protection Agency had declared a carcinogen, Middle America suddenly discovered organic. Panic for organic was the cover line on one Newsweekly, and overnight, demand from the supermarket chains soared. The ragtag industry was not quite ready for prime time, however. Like a lot of organic producers, Gene Con borrowed heavily to finance an ambitious expansion, contracted with farmers to grow an awful lot of organic produce, and then watched in horror as the bubble of demand subsided along with the headlines about Alar. Badly overextended, Con was forced to sell a majority stake in his company to Welch's, and the one-time hippie farmer set out on what he calls his corporate adventure. We were part of the food industry now, he told me, but I wanted to leverage that position to redefine the way we grow food, not what people want to eat or how we distribute it. That sure as hell isn't going to change. Becoming part of the food industry meant jettisoning two of the three original legs on which the organic movement had stood. The counter cuisine, what people want to eat, and the food co-ops and other alternative modes of distribution. Kahn's bet was that agribusiness could accommodate itself most easily to the first leg, the way we grow food, by treating organic essentially as a niche product that could be distributed and marketed through the existing channels. The original organic ideal held that you could not divorce these three elements, since, as ecology taught, everything was connected. But Gene Kahn, for one, and he was by no means the only one, was a realist, a businessman with a payroll to meet. And he wasn't looking back. You have a choice of getting sad about all that or moving on. We tried hard to build a cooperative community and a local food system, but in the end of the day, it wasn't successful. This is just lunch for most people. Just lunch. We can call it sacred. We can talk about communion, but it's just lunch. In the years after the Alar bubble burst in 1990, the organic industry recovered, embarking on a period of double-digit annual growth and rapid consolidation, as mainstream food companies began to take organic, or at least the organic market, seriously. Gerber's, Heinz, Dole, ConAgra, and ADM all created or acquired organic brands. Cascadian Farm itself became a mini-conglomerate, acquiring Muir Glen, a California organic tomato processor, and the combined company changed its name to Small Planet Foods. 1990 also marked the beginning of federal recognition for organic agriculture. That year, Congress passed the Organic Food and Production Act, OFPA. The legislation instructed the Department of Agriculture, which historically had treated organic farming with undisguised contempt, to establish uniform national standards for organic food and farming, fixing the definition of a word that had always meant different things to different people. Settling on that definition turned out to be a grueling, decade-long process, as various forces both within and outside the movement battled for control of a word that had developed a certain magic in the marketplace. Agribusiness fought to define the word as loosely as possible, in part to make it easier for mainstream companies to get into organic, but also out of fear that anything deemed not organic, such as genetically modified food, would henceforth carry an official stigma. At first, the USDA, acting out of long-standing habit, obliged its agribusiness clients, issuing a watery set of standards in 1997 that, astoundingly, allowed for the use of genetically modified crops and irradiation and sewage sludge in organic food production. Some saw the dark hand of companies like Monsanto or ADM at work, but it seems more likely the USDA was simply acting on the reasonable assumption that the organic industry, like any other industry, would want as light a regulatory burden as possible. But it turned out organic wasn't like other industries. It still had a lot of the old movement values in its genetic makeup, and it reacted to the weak standards with fury. An unprecedented flood of public comment from outraged organic farmers and consumers forced the USDA back to the drawing board in what was widely viewed as a victory for the movement's principles. Yet while the struggle with the government over the meaning of organic was making headlines in 1997, another equally important struggle was underway within the USDA between big and little organic. Or, put another way, between the organic industry and the organic movement. And here the outcome was decidedly more ambiguous. Could a factory farm be organic? Was an organic dairy cow entitled to graze on pasture? Did food additives and synthetic chemicals have a place in processed organic food? If the answers to these questions seem like no-brainers, then you too are stuck in an outdated pastoral view of organic. Big Organic won all three arguments. The final standards do a good job of setting the bar for a more environmentally responsible kind of farming, but, as perhaps was inevitable as soon as bureaucratic and industrial thinking was brought to bear, many of the philosophical values embodied in the word organic, the sorts of values expressed by Albert Howard, did not survive the federal rulemaking process. Gene Kahn served on the USDA's National Organic Standards Board from 1992 to 1997, where he played a key role in making the standards safe for the organic TV dinner and a great many other organic processed foods. This was no small feat, for Khan and his allies had to work around the original 1990 legislation, which had prohibited synthetic food additives and manufacturing agents outright. Khan argued that you couldn't have organic processed food without synthetics, which are necessary to both the manufacture and preservation of such supermarket products. Several of the consumer representatives of the Standards Board contended that this was precisely the point, and if no synthetics meant no organic TV dinners, then TV dinners were something organic simply shouldn't do. At stake was the very idea of a counter-cuisine. Joan Dye Gussow, a nutritionist and an outspoken Standards Board member, made the case against synthetics in a 1996 article that was much debated at the time. Can an organic Twinkie be certified? Demonstrating that under the proposed rules, such a thing was entirely possible, Gussow questioned whether organic should simply mirror the existing food supply, with its highly processed, salted, and sugary junk food, or whether it should aspire to something better, a counter cuisine based on whole foods. Khan responded with an argument rooted in the populism of the market. If the consumer wants an organic Twinkie, then we should give it to him. As he put it to me on the drive back from Cascadian Farm, organic is not your mother. In the end, it came down to an argument between the old movement and the new industry, and the new industry won. The final standard simply ignored the 1990 law, drawing up a list of permissible additives and synthetics, from ascorbic acid to xanthan gum. After Arthur Harvey, a Maine blueberry farmer, won a lawsuit forcing the USDA to obey the language of the 1990 law, lobbyists working for the Organic Trade Association managed to slip language into a USDA appropriations bill restoring, and possibly expanding, the industry's right to use synthetics in organic foods. If we had lost on synthetics, Khan told me, we'd be out of business. The same might be said for the biggest organic meat and dairy producers, who fought to make the new standards safe for the organic factory farm. Horizon Organics' Mark Retzloff labored mightily to preserve the ability of his company, which is the Microsoft of organic milk, controlling 50% of the market, to operate its large-scale industrial dairy in southern Idaho. Here in the western desert, where precious little grass can grow, the company was milking several thousand cows that, rather than graze on pasture, as most consumers presume their organic cows are doing, spend their days milling around a dry lot, a grassless, fenced enclosure. It's doubtful a dairy could pasture that many cows even if it wanted to. You would need at least an acre of grass per animal and more hours than there are in a day to move that many cows all the way out to their distant acre and then back again to the milking parlor every morning and evening. So instead, as in the typical industrial dairy, these organic cows stood around eating grain and silage when they weren't being milked 3 times a day. Their organic feed was shipped in from all over the West, and their waste accumulated in manure ponds. Retzloff argued that keeping cows in confinement meant that his farmhands, who all carried stethoscopes, could keep a closer eye on their health. Of course, cows only need this sort of surveillance when they're living in such close quarters and can't be given antibiotics. Such a factory farm didn't sound terribly organic to the smaller dairy farmers on the board, not to mention to the consumer representatives. Also, the OFPA had spelled out that the welfare of organic animals should take into account and accommodate their natural behavior, which in the case of cows, ruminants who have evolved to eat grass, surely meant grazing on pasture. You might say the whole pastoral idea was hardwired into these animals and stood squarely in the way of industrializing them. So how could the logic of industry ever hope to prevail? The USDA listened to the arguments on both sides and finally ruled that dairy cows must have access to pasture, which sounds like more of a victory for the pastoral ideal than it turned out to be in practice. By itself, access to pasture is an extremely vague standard. What constitutes access? How much pasture per animal? How often could it graze? And it was weakened further by a provision stating that even access could be dispensed with at certain stages of the animal's life. Some big organic dairies have decided that lactation constitutes one such stage, and thus far the USDA has not objected. Some of its organic certifiers have complained that access to pasture is so vague as to be meaningless, and therefore unenforceable. It's hard to argue with them. Along with the national list of permissible synthetics, access to pasture, and for other organic animals, access to the outdoors, indicate how the word organic has been stretched and twisted to admit the very sort of industrial practices for which it once offered a critique and an alternative. The final standards also demonstrate how, in Gene Kahn's words, everything eventually morphs into the way the world is. And yet, the pastoral values and imagery embodied in that word survive in the minds of many people, as the marketers of organic food well understand. Just look at a container of organic milk, with its happy cows and verdant pastures. Thus is a venerable ideal hollowed out, reduced to a sentimental conceit printed on the side of a milk carton. Supermarket pastoral. Down on the industrial organic farm. Get over it, Gene Kahn would say. The important thing, the real value of putting organic on an industrial scale, is the sheer amount of acreage it puts under organic management. Behind every organic TV dinner or chicken or carton of industrial organic milk stands a certain quantity of land that will no longer be doused with chemicals, an undeniable gain for the environment and the public health. I could see his point. So I decided to travel to California to see these farms for myself. Why California? Because the state's industrial agriculture grows most of America's produce, and organic has in large part become a subset or brand of that agriculture. No farms I have ever visited before prepared me for the industrial organic farms I saw in California. When I think about organic farming, I think family farm. I think small scale. I think hedgerows and compost piles and battered pickups. The old agrarian idea, which in fact has never had much purchase in California. I don't think migrant labor crews, combines the size of houses, mobile lettuce-packing factories marching across fields of romaine, 20,000 broiler chicken houses, or hundreds of acres of corn or broccoli or lettuce reaching clear to the horizon. To the eye, these farms look exactly like any other industrial farm in California. And in fact, some of the biggest organic operations in the state are owned and operated by conventional mega farms. The same farmer who is applying toxic fumigants to sterilize the soil in one field is in the next field applying compost to nurture the soil's natural fertility. Is there anything wrong with this picture? I'm not sure, frankly. Gene Kahn makes the case that the scale of a farm has no bearing on its fidelity to organic principles, and that unless organic scales up, it will never be anything more than yuppie food. To prove his point, Kahn sent me to visit several of the large-scale farms that supply Small Planet Foods. These included Greenways, the Central Valley operation that grows vegetables for his frozen dinners, and tomatoes for Muir Glen, and Petaluma Poultry, which grows the chicken in his frozen dinner, as well as Rosie, the organic chicken I made the acquaintance of in Whole Foods. I also paid a visit to the Salinas Valley, where Earthbound Farm, the largest organic grower in the world, has most of its lettuce fields. My first stop was Greenways Organic, a successful 2,000-acre organic produce operation tucked into a 24,000-acre conventional farm in the Central Valley outside Fresno. The crops, the machines, the crews, the rotations, and the fields were virtually indistinguishable, and yet two different kinds of industrial agriculture are being practiced here, side by side. In many respects, the same factory model is at work in both fields, but for every chemical input used in the farm's conventional fields, a more benign organic input has been substituted in the organic ones. So in place of petrochemical fertilizers, Greenway's organic acres are nourished by compost made by the ton at a horse farm nearby, and by poultry manure. Instead of toxic pesticides, insects are controlled by spraying approved organic agents, most of them derived from plants, such as rotenone, pyrethrum, and nicotine sulfate, and by introducing beneficial insects like lacewings. Inputs and outputs. A much greener machine, but a machine nevertheless. End of Disc 5. Perhaps the greatest challenge to